Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
The suicide of French Vivi was a shock. But not shocking. There was no rush and no fuss, just sadness. Felicity would state, "I made a cup of tea and took it to the bedroom. The door was half open. I saw Madame on her back, with her feet on the floor and with one shoe and stocking off. I said, 'Madam, here's your tea.' I touched her hand. She was dead and cold." Descending to the Globe Club on the first floor, in broken English, Felicity stammered, "Madam dead." As hysterical as anyone who had found their friend of 15 years, deceased. Seeing her distress, Charles Bull the manager, Joseph Phillips the doorkeeper, and Lance George an actor, entered the bedroom of flat one on the third floor of 3-4 Archer Street, and saw her body, at peace, on the bed. With Soho being a place synonymous with sex, the suicide of a prostitute was not an uncommon sight, given the stresses of their lives. Charles Bull alerted a constable. PC Hill secured the scene and summoned a doctor. Dr. Rhea Frith Street pronounced life as extinct, and as her cause of death had to be determined, as suicide was still a criminal offence, the CID of Vine Street were called in. With the investigation headed up by Divisional Detective Inspector John Edwards and Chief Superintendent Walter Hambrook. The crime scene was assessed methodically. The door to flat one was examined by a locksmith who determined there was no tampering, no damage, and no signs of a break-in. The flat had three keys, one for Fifi, one for her maid, and one for the landlady, all of which were accounted for, with Fifi's found in her handbag in the bedroom. With the light switches to the hallway and the bedroom in the on position, a shilling in the meter, but both light bulbs off, it was assumed she had died with the lights on, only for the money to run out. As a spotlessly clean flat, it was clear what had been touched since the maid had left 36 hours prior. The ashtray contained several stubs of spent cigarettes of different brands, belonging to herself and the men she may have entertained that night, as well as one plate, one knife, one fork and one cup, all used for a last meal before bed, with an oily pan on the hob and a pot of tea on the kitchen table, half drunk and cold. Found days later, witnesses came forward and pieced together her last known possible movements. A chat with the doorman at Max Club on Great Windmill Street at 2 a.m. and a black coffee at the Old Friars Cafe in Ham Yard before she left and headed one street east to Archer Street. Both witnesses confirm she was alone and she seemed a little lonely. But she didn't seem harassed and no one was following her. Speaking to her friends, no one recalled anything suspicious in the days prior. No threats, no stalking, and no unusual levels of assault for this struggling sex worker with debts to several local businesses. Speaking to the building's tenants proved equally as fruitless. As with both clubs, the Globe and the Cairo closed, the communal street door was locked at midnight. The second floor was vacant, and the fourth floor flats were uninhabited. All the police could rely on was the account of Millie Warren, her neighbour in flat 2. At 1 a.m, I passed her door, Minnie would state, and I noticed her hall light was on. This was unusual. I shouted to her, but I got no reply. At 2 a.m, in a taxi, I came back with a friend, William Charles Hill, known as John Cow. He spent the night. We stayed up until about 4:30 a.m, and we heard nothing. In the bedroom, there were no signs of disturbance. Her coat was on the chair. Her drawers were shut. Her ornaments were on the dresser. Her wireless radio was where it sat, as determined by the slight bleaching of sunlight. And the curtains were open, roughly 12 inches. Meaning that at the time of her death, her bed and her body was illuminated by either a single bulb above or the streetlights on a timed circuit. Had this been an assault, a sense of panic and fear would have pervaded the room. But it was entirely calm. Her body was positioned as expected, as having sat on the bed's edge to remove her stocking. She had tied it about her neck and fallen backwards, leaving her feet on the floor and her head on the pillow. Her clothes were neat and undisturbed. Her brown tweed skirt still fastened with a safety pin. Her underwear, blue silk cami knickers, a pair of woolen knickers and a white woolen vest hadn't been interfered with. And off her white linen and satin suspender belt was a fake silk stocking on her right leg. As off her left leg, a stocking had been unclipped and carefully rolled down without a tear, run or rip. As she had then placed her blue court shoe under the bed. Tied twice about her neck. Those who found her body didn't see the stocking, as it was concealed by a grey woolen jumper. As seen in traumatic deaths, often the deceased dies with their last expression etched on their face, a hint of shock, fear, or tears. Whereas Fifi's face was the epitome of peace, like her pain had been erased. By the night's end, she looked as she had at the start. Her lips rouged red, her eyelids brushed black. Her short brown bob kept in place with a set of Kirby grips, and her claw-like fingernails unbroken. With no suicide note found, her mood was determined by the detritus of worry which littered her bedside dresser. Post office receipts to send her lover Jimmy a few pounds to aid his recovery from heroin addiction, and her final fine and court summons for the crime of prostitution. At 1:50 p.m., Divisional Police Surgeon Charles Burney undertook a preliminary examination of the body in situ, ensuring it was neither touched nor moved, to preserve any evidence, no matter how small. The stocking was tied about her neck using a half-hitch knot. A common but carefully considered load-bearing knot, which, once she had started to lose consciousness, which would have occurred early given her low blood pressure, she would need a knot which retained its position as her hands and body went limp. Dr. Burney would state that with a few of her hairs and her grey jumper's tassel tangled within, it is possible that it was caught up in the knot while she was standing or sitting. It was tied by a right-hander. Fifi was right-handed, and she died clutching the stocking in her right hand. Initially, her cause of death was most likely asphyxia. She had been dead for 8 to 10 hours, putting her time of death at between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. Although rigor mortis is delayed in cases of sudden death. And when asked for a suspected motive, Dr. Burney would state, "It was probably a case of suicide." But when asked how certain he was, he would state, "It was 50-50. At 6 p.m., as the body of Josephine Martin was moved to Westminster Mortuary, the press had begun sniffing about the death of a prostitute in the seedy underbelly of the West End.
"Extra, extra! Read all about it! Italy's big push in Abyssinia!"
was the headline in the Daily Telegraph, as the Second Italo-Ethiopian War raged on. With a British election looming, the Evening Standard went with,
"New MPs announced!"
And as the tabloid motto is, "If it bleeds, it leads," the press was salivating over the grisly murders of Dr. Buck Ruxton. A murder so savage that having mutilated their bodies into so many pieces, the press had dubbed him the Savage Surgeon and his crimes as the Jigsaw Murders. The death of French Fifi was deemed so unimportant that the small articles reporting the case were deeply hidden in the newspapers, and they would have been binned had it not been a slow news day. Keen to play up the salacious angles, the press slathered over any fact to make this dull story drip with intrigue. That she was French, unmarried, and a prostitute. They drooled over every detail about the stocking, the flat, and her habits. And they even added their own flourishes, like artificial respiration was tried in vain, which was untrue. They did anything to make it exciting, as suicides don't sell newspapers. In the Daily Herald, dated the 5th of November 1935, it read, "Woman's death mystery in West End flat. Strangled by her own stocking. Scotland Yard officers investigating the death mystery of a woman in a Soho flat had not ruled out the possibility that she'd been murdered." The autopsy to determine her cause of death was still taking place. And yet this detail was enough of a seed to plant a hint of a mystery, a of a possible murder. With the public only able to get their facts from newspapers. By the time the witnesses to Fifi's last sightings were unearthed, their information had already been sullied by what they had read. Interviewed days after her death, the doorman and the cafe owner were deemed reliable witnesses, although it couldn't be determined if they had actually seen her on the night of her death, or hours or days prior. Witness statements are notoriously flawed, often being riddled with elaboration, confusion, fibs, false facts, and downright lies, as everybody has their own reason to aid an investigation. Some may be good Samaritans, simply keen to do what is right, whereas others are in it for fame, spite, or personal gain. Head waiter at the Criterion restaurant in Piccadilly Circus stated he saw French Fifi with two women in the grill room at 3:30 a.m. This turned out to be an entirely different French brunette, as by that point, she was already dead. Taxi driver Charles Branch confirmed in his logbook that at 1:30 a.m. in the night in question, he picked up a small woman from 3 to 4 Archer Street, drove her to Caledonian Road near King's Cross, where she waited for a man. He drove them both back to her address, and they both entered via the street door. He later stated, "Owing to her mannerisms, it struck me at the time that something was wrong." The police would determine that she had climbed the stairs to the third floor and entered her flat with the man. Only this woman was Millie Warren, her neighbour, and the man was Millie's friend, William Charles Hill. And then there was Sidney Bloom, a Jewish seller of contraception to prostitutes in the West End, who had volunteered information that between 9:15 p.m. and 10 p.m, he had seen Fifi on Glasshouse Street with a man. But being described as an incorrigible rogue with 9 convictions for larceny, he had offered his assistance to the police, having first informed them of his own impending trial, a tit-for-tat scam he had done several times prior. Discounting his sighting, Sidney Bloom was later sentenced to 4 months hard labour. On Tuesday the 5th of November 1935, at 11:30 a.m, the autopsy began at Westminster Mortuary, conducted by Home Office pathologist Sir Bernard Spilsbury, in the presence of the police surgeon Dr. Charles Burney and Divisional Detective Inspector John Edwards. In it, the following was agreed. Time of death. Difficult to determine, as the heating was meter-powered and the window was partially open, making the room temperature inconsistent. The body was rigid, and putrefactive gases were felt beneath the skin. Therefore, this would place her time of death nearer to the hours of 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. The deceased was healthy, with no natural disease to account for her death. She was small and often sickly, but she was well developed and could have put up a good resistance to an attack. With no torn clothing, no bruises to her thighs, and no semen inside her vagina, there was no indication of any recent act of sexual intercourse or any attempt at the time of her death. Some recent and old bruises, but nothing within the last day. but later found, hidden amongst the purple swelling of her neck, was a fresh bruise to her left jaw. Although given the abuse that prostitutes often endure, the police would later state, "Try and find a West End prostitute who doesn't have bruises to her face and neck." In her kitchen, she had made a last meal for one. But with her stomach only containing a brown liquid, most likely tea, and tomato or apple skin not found in the flat, with no trace of a fried egg in her gastric juices, either she had eaten them earlier that night, or someone else had eaten the eggs. Both doctors confirmed that her cause of death was asphyxia by strangulation. As her larynx was crushed, her tongue was swollen, her eyes protruded from their sockets, and she had wet herself. But Sir Bernard would query, "If she had died by ligature strangulation, I would have expected to see more lividity." Her face was at peace when she died. But he would state, "That is no guide as to whether it was murder or suicide." Having been photographed, the stocking was removed and sent to the laboratory. Twisted taut, bound twice, and tied tightly about her neck, the stocking had been fastened with a half-hitched knot under her right ear, suggesting it had been secured by a right-handed person, like Fifi. And although the suddenness of her unconsciousness could account for the lack of scratches or struggle, Sir Bernard would comment, "She had either died or was at the point of death when the ligature was tied." After the hand was removed from the neck, she gave a gasp or two. The bloodstained mucus in the airways was then inhaled. Vomit got into the airway, and the stocking was passed around her neck twice, tied in a half hitch, and held for a while. When found, the ligature was tight and secure. Of that, Sir Bernard would quip, "I have never known a woman to strangle herself with her own hand." Partially obscured by the stocking and its ensuing swollen wounds, bruises were later observed. 4 fingers to the right of the neck and a thumb mark to the left. Being larger than her own, their origin was impossible to date for a prostitute who had recently been attacked by a foreigner who had got hold of her throat. At the back of her blood-stained mouth, having bitten her tongue, her dental plate of 4 teeth mounted on vulcanite was found shattered into 3 pieces. Possibly linked to the bruise on her jaw, Sir Bernard would state, "In my opinion, the breaking of the dental plate is indicative of murder." And with hemorrhages in the bladder, intestines, and rectum, it was clear a knee had been pressed hard on her abdomen. With so many variables, like whether her injuries were the result of 2 different assaults on the same or separate nights, an assault which led to her suicide, or an attack which led to her murder. Although Dr. Spilsbury was emphatic, this was a homicide, Dr. Burney was torn, as this still could be a suicide. The 2 experts would debate this for the next 3 weeks, leaving Detective Inspector Edwards to conclude his report of the 9th of November 1935, as the whole circumstances of the case are mysterious. The police needed time to compile the evidence to find the truth. They had several possible suspects. Henry V. Martin, her ex-husband by a possible marriage of convenience, was later traced to America, having not seen her for more than a decade. Albert Mechanique, her brother, had an alibi for the night of her death, and although dubbed a common criminal who was always in debt, it made no sense for Albert to murder his sister, as she had financially been supporting him for the last few months. As for her lovers, César Mary was in Brussels at the time of the murder, and although he had stated, "It was French Fifi who put me away," he was neither angry, upset, and even after his deportation, he had never made any threats against her. As for Jimmy Orr, he had arrived at Caldecott Hall in Nuneaton 2 days earlier to begin his drug detox. And as confirmed by his doctors, he didn't leave the premises until he was made aware of her death. With no regular clients, and those she was in debt to being friends, the police interviewed hundreds of witnesses, suspects, and anyone with a history of violence against prostitutes, but they came up blank. The public fed them their suspicions, usually ex-lovers and former friends, in the hope of getting them into trouble, as well as the usual bigoted band of society's villains who were blamed for everything simply because they were different, such as foreigners, gays, Jews, bohemians, the insane, and the disabled. With nothing new to say, the police went quiet. And with nothing new to report, the press went into overdrive. November 6th, the Daily Herald. Silt stocking riddle baffles police. Nearly 2 days after the discovery of the body, Scotland Yard are unable to state how she died. Acquaintances of French Fifi told us they had always feared that sooner or later she would be killed by some man. The source of that quote was never found, and by that point, her death was still listed as a suicide. The Herald incorrectly wrote, "Detectives believe that robbery was the motive. Friends declare Fifi had large sums of money in her flat," which was untrue, as she was broke and only 1p was found. The Evening Standard also declared, "£9 gone from stocking of dead woman." And although her friends would confirm, she kept her money in the heel of her left stocking, it is impossible to say how much she earned or what had happened to it, whether it was spent, stolen, sent to Jimmy and subsequently lost. Or as the police suspected, it is possible that it may have been stolen by those who had found her body, most of whom were criminals. Awaiting the outcome of the autopsy, the press wrote about plain-clothed officers patrolling Soho, suspicious men being followed, and unverified quotes by mystery sources about imminent arrests. But as the days of radio silence turned into weeks with no solid facts, the press needed to find a fresh angle to keep their readers interested, some of which was born out of a tiny nugget of truth. The press had already decided two things. One, that she had been murdered. And two, as the police intensified their search of scores of cafes and nightclubs in the West End, in an intensive combing of the underworld, that a murderer must be local, working class, possibly foreign, and a known criminal. One day after her death, the Daily Herald declared, "We understand that the woman was believed to have given evidence, which, this year, had led to a sensational court case." Of course, there was no record of that court case, no mention of it in her police files, and not one single newspaper reported this sensational court case in the months prior to her death. But if you print it, the people will believe it to be fact. On the 27th of November 1935, the People stated, "Death of French Fifi baffles Scotland Yard. Was she the victim of a gang of white slavers? Some believe she made statements which led to their arrests." Now this was true with César Mary, but as a French prostitute, there was no known evidence that she was ever trafficked. On the 1st of December 1935, the Sunday Pictorial, a sleazy tabloid rag, raised the stakes, stating, "French Fifi was a white slaver, murdered by gang because she knew too much." Which there was no proof of, but given the fact that she was already dead, they could print whatever they liked, even if it was entirely false. The article read, "French Fifi had an amazing career in the underworld, which the police are now fully aware." This was a lie. She is said to have been an agent of a gang of white slave traffickers. She wasn't. For months, Scotland Yard has been waging war on marriages of convenience. This was true, although her only known link was her suspiciously short marriage. And some days before French Fifi was found murdered, a Scotland Yard inspector called to see her to obtain information about gang members. The gang had communicated with her, as letters from one of its members were found in her flat. French Fifi had undoubtedly paid the penalty for knowing too much. And yet, not a single shred of what was written could be proven. For simple-minded readers of such tabloid trash, who couldn't comprehend that a newspaper's role is as much to inform as it is to entertain, a basic fact had entirely passed them by. If Fifi was a white slaver, why was she so poor? Why did she work alone? And why did she still sell her body for sex? After 3 weeks of deliberation, Sir Bernard Spilsbury and Dr. Charles Burney resolved their findings into the autopsy of Josephine Martin, alias French Fifi. Reopened on Tuesday the 26th of November 1935 at 2 p.m, the inquest into her death was held at Westminster Coroner's Court, with several witnesses giving evidence, including her friends, Frieda Martin, Clara Bennett and Lily Hayes, her neighbour Millicent Warren, and Home Office pathologist Sir Bernard Spilsbury. The inquest was concluded the same day, with the coroner declaring, "Her death was willful murder by person or persons unknown." Although the pathologist would state, This is a likelihood of probability, not a cast iron fact. With no suspects to be questioned, and no eyewitnesses to her murder, both the investigation and the inquest were closed. Just like Jack the Ripper, 3 miles east and almost 50 years earlier, the murderer of French Fifi had fled unseen, leaving no clues as to his motive or his identity. Having vanished into thin air, it was as if he didn't exist. And with this death, initially mistaken for a suicide, no one knew that this was the first fledgling killing by a serial killer who had stalked the sex workers of West London's red light district. By 1935, the Soho Strangler was nothing, being barely a whisper on the breeze. But with his killing spree just beginning, soon this man would become a monster. A sadistic slayer who would unleash terror onto the streets, making him as infamous in his day as Jack the Ripper. And then be forgotten. Part 3 of The Soho Strangler continues next week.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Oh, that was a harder one to say. I gave myself too many big, big sentences to say and some big paragraphs. Oh, dear Lord. Oh, I'm going to get rid of all my high-tech equipment. You sometimes see on people post videos of their high-tech equipment when they're doing their podcasts. They go, I want to come on high-tech equipment. Mine is a couple of boxes with a laptop on top, a microphone on top with my little shield, and then some pillows behind the curtains to stop the sound of those fucking coots. They haven't been too bad today. They've been relatively quiet, except sometimes they just seem to mouth off all day. Oops, mouth off all day, and you just think, why is this what you do? You just hump all day. You just go, oh, I need to have sexy time. They are the wildlife equivalent of Eva. So demanding. Anyway, it's a nice day. Oh, have I said welcome to Extra Mile? I don't think I have. Welcome to Extra Mile. Unscripted, unedited, blah, blah, blah. We do a quiz in a bit. I tell you some extra stuff. And then I go away to the coffee shop. Although I'm going to go to the... try and go to post office today because I've been trying for ages to send some parcels to America, but because I mean we're not going to say it was Russia, but it was Russia who did the cyber attack on the Royal Mail. I haven't been able to post
those. I think that's it. I think Putin didn't want me to send some mugs to America. Yeah, he's terrified of me sending mugs to America, so he deliberately stopped it. Utter bastard. Anyway, I'm still trying to sort out my pillow here. There we go. I'm just putting the covers back on them. There we go. God, it's cold out. It's cold out. It's cold out. Let me take off your little hat. There you go, your little hat's off. And let me go and make a cuppa, because it's bloody cold and I need a cup of tea. There we go. And of course, exactly like last week, I did it again. I forgot to thank my Patreon subscribers. It's because I put it on a piece of paper. I put it on a piece of paper on a different file that I don't normally use. And oh, what an idiot. Anyway, I would like to thank this week Rachel Hammond, Madeline Hartley, and Dawn Raymond. So thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Madeline. Thank you, Dawn, for becoming Patreon subscribers. I hope you're getting all the lovely goodies that comes with being a Patreon subscriber. And hopefully you've got your goodies in the post. So let's return back to the show. Let's add a little bit of water. I don't want much. So I'm going to be abusing Starbucks very shortly. Having their decaf soya latte. Oh, joy. Nice, they stay open till 8 and they don't mind me sitting there, which is very nice. So let's do a herbal tea. So here we go, that's it. Gotta remember to take my post in a bit. Remind me to take over my post to the post office. I knocked over my little Christmas tree as well. There we go. Right. Oh, so what else is going on? I've spent most of that recording burping the smell of crab sticks. That was my lunch, crab sticks. I'm going to put my little hat on because I'm cold, because I've got a baldy head and I'm cold. Crab sticks and mini cheddars. Yummy. Naturally, I'm sitting here in the boat. It's too early to put on a fire, so I've got my pyjamas on, a woolly top on top, woolly hat, fingerless gloves, and I'm just about to warm myself up with a tea. Sometimes I grab myself a hot water bottle as well. God, my life's exciting, isn't it? What else is going on? There's a man who keeps... He walks along the canal. He's got a big bag of bread and he keeps throwing bread for all the birds. But he keeps forgetting, like, all the seagulls come around and they go, "Oh, great birds." And he's like, "Oh, look at me. I'm a friendless man. But I've made friends with all these birds." But he keeps forgetting that... You give them bread and then they shit all over our boats. Utter bastard. Ah, what else is going on? Working on some new videos. If you're a Patreon subscriber, they're on there. Got some ones that I pop on the old TikTok as well. Very good. I had to learn to use a new system called Canva. And it's really annoying because it's not a proper editing tool. It's slightly frustrating and you can only add one kind of sound to it, which I normally like lots of sounds, and it's confusing how it's edited, but I've worked out a secret way of making it work, and I'm very proud with my latest version. It was all right, considering, not too bad. So water's still heating up. Let's do some quiz questions. We'll do the answers very shortly and we'll dive into some extra stuff. I hope you're enjoying the Soho Strangler. Different to what I've done before. You'll understand more as you go through the series, because normally with like Blackout Ripper, you're following like one murderer throughout. But this is different. This is five different murder cases. And they're very different in their own way, but they're connected as well. So this isn't like one where you just go, "Oh, look, there's the murderer," and you just follow him. You've really got to put your hat on for this one. This is because it's a very complicated case, and it takes us into like some really weird worlds, and you see a different side to what we've normally seen before, which is why I like this case. You know, it starts with something that as simple as a possible suicide, which in the end they kind of deduce it could be a murder. It's most likely to be a murder, but we can't definitely prove it. And then it becomes more complicated as we go through this. It really does become a really interesting case. Anyway, that was just waffle. Let's do some quiz questions. My tea's about to go in a second. Quiz question number one. Here we go. What colour was Fifi's court shoe. So the shoe she was wearing, court shoes, what colour were they? Question number two. What was the name of the man who sold condoms to sex workers? Question number three. On what street did Charles Branch, the taxi driver, claim he had picked up Fifi and a tall man? Question number four. How were Fifi's fingernails described? Question number five. What was the name of the first PC to attend the scene? That looks like my teaser at the go. I mean, I made it too hot, which is a bit stupid. Oh, I got an apple pie for later on. Yeah. I made my tea too hot, so I'll slurp this in a bit, and then I'll say the words, "Oh, it's too hot," burning my lips, and then... Stupid. Although I am drinking it out of my Blackout Ripper mug, of which I think that's one of the last ones now. Yeah, it is the last one. I've got some Stay Safe Eat Cake mugs, I've got some Reg Christie mugs, and I've only got four PC Police Constable Arsenal Guinness mugs left. Oh, right. Where was I? Question number six. How much money was found in Fifi's handbag? Question number seven. How much money was in the electricity meter? Question number eight. Millie's friend... William Charles Hill went by what alias? Question number nine. What colour was Fifi's jumper? And question number ten. Why is it likely that she passed out early, having been strangled? As always, I've kind of half written those questions. I admit, I'd finished writing it, then I went, oh shit, I need to do the bloody quiz questions. So I had to kind of dive into them quickly. Normally when I'm rewriting the script, normally I do the questions then as I'm rewriting it, but I forgot this time. Still getting used to doing podcasts again. So what have we got? Let's dive into some of the witnesses. This is something that we dive into more in this case, of how, you know, just because someone says they've seen something doesn't mean it's truthful. It doesn't mean it's 100% cast iron and you have to accept it. This is what I really want to get across in the Soho Strangler case. You can see it with, this is what I'm implying with the Jack the Ripper case. Jack the Ripper, there's not a lot of any evidence out there, but what we do have is what was written by the press. And the problem is when you start getting all the press's details together of the same event and you put them side by side, you realise that it's not verbatim, it's not fact. It's quite often, it's hastily written, they've cobbled it together, they've pieced together their own little facts, they've added in bits, they've kind of changed stuff, and it's, you know, whereas with witness statements, it should be accurate, whereas luckily with the Blackout Ripper, we have witness statements. But even people on the street, it's like when they come to the police afterwards, a couple of days later, they go, oh, I think I saw French Fifi. But that's only after the point, after they've read about it in the papers, they've seen her picture, they've read about what she was doing, and then they make the connection. And it could be entirely wrong. So the head waiter at the grill room at the Criterion restaurant on Piccadilly, the Criterion is the restaurant where the Blackout Ripper used to pick up some of his ladies as well. Head waiter said he saw a woman he believed was French Fifi 3rd of November at about, he said initially around 11 p.m. she was with two women who he believed was French. All of this is believed. This is the problem. And that she returned at 3:30. Of course, by that point, she was already dead. And that's the problem. He was trying to be helpful, but the police have to investigate all of these pieces of information, and it's just wrong. It's wrong. So he's not being a dickhead about it. He's just trying to be helpful, but... You know, some people go, "Ooh, I'm going to help," because they want to be able to tell their friends afterwards. You know, oh, the police investigation. Yeah, they came to me because I'm kind of, yeah, I think I saw her, and I think I've got the key facts to solve it. You haven't got the key facts. Well done, Michael. You are not going to mention his name. The gentleman who sold prophylactics, as they call it here, preventatives, to prostitutes in the Soho West End area. He volunteered his information to the police. He said he knew Fifi Martin. A lot of people do refer to her as Fifi Martin, because I forget her surname was Martin. Let's go down to the details below. This is the bit I liked. So 24th of December 1936, just afterwards, he offered to assist the police with their inquiries into the murder of Josephine Martin. He was described in court as an incorrigible rogue. That was his criminal offence. One of them was being an incorrigible rogue. What a sentence. We should bring that back. Because he was... That's incorrigible rogue is kind of false pretenses, you know, getting things under false pretenses. He received 4 months hard labour for that. He'd already got 9 previous convictions. Police stated there was no doubt that this man is connected with all of the criminals in the West End. He has on several occasions come to the police station offering information. So... they wouldn't accept him on that. And of course we've got Charles Branch as well. See, this one is, it was reported in the press that did anyone see French Fifi? She was on Archer Street. He's a local driver. He'd heard that she was murdered. What a noise outside. People always seem to go past the boat and decide, I'm going to shout outside Michael's boat. Utter annoying bellends. So he'd found out that where she lived, it was reported in the press that she'd been murdered there. He looked at his logbook. He was like, oh my god, I picked up someone there. Fifi was a small lady. Millie was a small lady. They were both 5 foot tall. The problem is Fifi was a brunette. Millie was blonde. Millie was about 15 years younger as well. I think she was early to mid 20s. So he kind of got the details right. She did go in the right door. She did go up to the third floor. That's where her flat was, but it was the wrong flat. But obviously he didn't go up the stairs to follow her to go, oh, are you going into flat one where the murderer is going to happen later tonight? So you know, his details could have been good. It could have possibly led to the murderer, but unfortunately it was her neighbour. As mentioned, we got the initial in situ autopsy. So that's what happened right at the start. That's what they always do. When a body is at the scene, they obviously don't move the body straight away. The pathologist comes in. They don't move the body. They take all the pictures that they have to. They don't move the body. And they try and assess as much as they can without moving anything at all. Because otherwise you start losing data. So that's what they did at the scene. And all of the data in front of them right then suggested that it was a suicide. Which is why we end with part one with a suicide. And we start with this one being a suicide as well. As mentioned, it was almost impossible for them to kind of see, for the people who found her body to see that she'd tied a stocking around her neck, because it looks like she was either standing up, most likely sitting down, but upright on the bed when it was tied around her neck. As mentioned, it was tied around her neck, part of the tassel and one of the buttons got tied around the knot in her neck that was on her jumper that got tied through, and some hairs as well. She passed out, she fell backwards. The rest of her jumper kind of obscured the stocking as well, which is why they couldn't see that. Also, the room wasn't particularly well lit. You know, you got sunlight coming in, but when you look at the street, it's quite a narrow, high street. So you only really get sunlight for a couple of hours. Her mouth was partially open, tongue was visible, slightly protruding, her eyes were almost closed, but her pupils dilated, her skin was livid, and they determined her time of death was about 8 to 10 hours prior, putting her time of death at about between 4 and 6. This would later be re-established later on. Although, when Sir Bernard Spilsby initially looked at the body, because the timings were all off, he initially stated that he thought the body had died at 9 p.m., which I mean, it's a possibility, but then you have to discount a lot of witnesses by that point. Dr. Burney stated, because he could see no additional bruising by that point, there was already bruising caused by the strangulation. Therefore, her neck and a kind of a higher portion of her lower part of her face was already kind of very livid, very purple. So it's hard to see bruises going in. He said because he couldn't see any additional bruising, he would have expected bruisings to her hand, her arms, her forearms, possibly her thighs. Couldn't see any of that at all. Therefore, he said it's probably a case of suicide. But when asked, he said he was 50-50 on that. And I actually, you know, respect to both of them on this, that even though it was difficult to determine, they didn't just jump to the decision and go, well, you know what, it's probably a murder. It's like they were both at loggerheads about this. Spilsby was like, it's, as we know, Spilsby can be quite, he doesn't like working with other people. He's quite belligerent. He can be quite arrogant. And he believes in his own abilities a lot. Therefore, it kind of makes everything, sometimes it's hard to kind of accept his evidence sometimes, as we've seen in some of the earlier cases, well, especially Crippen. Dr. Burney kind of, he didn't stick to his guns, but he said, look, there's still a kind of a waiver here. Is it suicide or is it murder? And as you can see with the inquest at the end, they even said it's murder by persons or persons unknown, but this is on balance of probability. This is not fact. So even at the end, they still couldn't say, they said it's most likely a murder, but, you know, we don't have evidence to say this is the person that did it, this is how it happened. And that's kind of the tragedy of her life as well. There's a lot of abuse going on. You know, she's being beaten up, she's being strangled by various punters who turn up, want to have sex with a lot of the assaults that were happening to her prior. A lot of them seem to be men turning up. She would want the money in advance, quite rightly, because you want to get paid in advance and not have him go, oh, I'm pissing off now. I've had my sex. I'm buggering off. But also there's that kind of debate about whether she was slightly, because she was finding it more difficult to kind of earn enough money to survive, that she was kind of saying that she would charge this amount, but when they turned up, she would charge a higher amount. So there's a lot of issues with that as well. Spilsbury, the autopsy held at Westminster Mortuary, which is on Horse Ferry Road. It was cause of death, asphyxia. I always trouble to say that. Asphyxia. What else we got? Spilsbury did not rule out the possibility of suicide, he considered it a case of homicide. So even through that, it's constantly flip-flacking around. The suddenness of the unconsciousness accounts for the lack of scratches or struggle. She had either died or was at the point of death when the ligature was passed around her neck. I think after the hand was removed from the neck, she gave a gasp or two and then vomit got into the air passageway. And then her assailant may have then passed the stocking around her neck twice, tied a half hitch, and then held it for a while. It remained quite tight. It may seem like in parts one and two, there's a lot of details in there and things that you think, well, that's not important. But there's a lot of details in here that are going to keep coming back again and again as we go throughout the series. So a lot to discover. So I'd be interested to know whether the bruise to her face was caused by her murderer. Because that's exactly the same technique as the Blackout Ripper, but you know, this is not unique to him. This is kind of a standard thing for those kind of creepy, nasty little wankers who decide to attack women. You know, punch to the face to render them unconscious or kind of dazed, pushing them onto the bed. He may have put his knee onto her abdomen to pin her down. As we know with the Blackout Ripper, he would put his thighs either side of the arms to pin them down, and then he would go for the strangulation attack. Of course, this is not the Blackout Ripper. We know where he was at that point, and this wasn't him at all. Be interesting if it was, though. That would be fascinating. With Spilsbury, as mentioned here, I like his little comment there. A bit of a quip, but he says, I've never known a woman to strangle herself with her own hand. He did actually later state that there was one potential case earlier on in his career in which he thought it may have happened. But he said it's highly unlikely. But that the breaking of the dental plate inside her mouth was indicative of murder. A dental plate. She had four false teeth. One of them was missing. We don't know where that wasn't found in the room. We don't know where that is. It may have been missing for ages because her dental plate was old and worn, they described it as. So it may have been partially broken already, but it could have been the, if it was the punch to the jaw, that could have broken the dental plate, which is why it was broken and found at the back of her throat. What else is there? The contents of her stomach. Was she the person who ate the fried eggs? There was definitely fried eggs made. They were cold. We don't know whether she ate them before she left, if she left about 5:30, 6 o'clock, or whether she came back later on and ate the eggs. If she did eat them earlier on, that kind of makes sense. Or if she ate them before she went to bed, but they weren't found in her stomach, all that was found was brown liquid, which is likely to be tea, as she wasn't a drinker. That would ask the question, who ate the eggs? No signs of sexual assault. She wasn't raped. She was in good health. They said she would have been able to put up a good resistance. People who kind of knew her said, you know, she may have been little, but she was quite feisty. In one of the police reports, they describe her as vicious. I personally wouldn't. There's a longer section in here about how the police kind of describe her, and I think it's unfair to say the police. It is really just the person who wrote the that particular report, and it's kind of indicative of kind of that era as well. But there's bits and pieces in there. The same with Ginger Ray as well, where you had all of the prostitutes giving really invaluable evidence as to where Ginger Ray was in the hours leading up to her murder, but the police discounted it and they said, well, they're all prostitutes, therefore they're all liars. Unfortunately, in this case, they did the same. They were like, well, these are all prostitutes or they're connected to crimes, therefore they can't be trusted. But then you've got Millicent Warren, who was a neighbour in flat two, who's also a prostitute, and they've accepted her evidence as verbatim. Which makes sense because she was an immediate neighbour, but why accept one lot of evidence from someone who you regard as untrustworthy? Do you know, you either do or you don't. Or, do you know, as we will see with later cases, it's clear when they pick someone and they go, right, I like with the man whose name I shall not mention, who sells condoms, do you know, there's a good reason to not trust him because he's turning up at police stations going, oh, I've got a court case coming up. If you, I'll tell you the information you want if you help me out and get me a lesser charge. Apparently, that's what he was doing. Bit of a tit. What else we got? Lovely comment that I used at the end. I think it was Chief Constable Howell who actually gave that comment, where he's describing in the report her as the dead prostitute. It's interesting because when you read the report with Dr. Burney, he's always described as Dr. Burney. Sir Bernard Spilsbury is given his full title, but with the victim, it's just the dead prostitute. It's just like she's just being described based on the fact that she's dead and her job. What else is there? Potentially a right-handed assailant. That's the thing. They still don't know exactly where the attacks happened because it's so close to her point of death. She could have been attacked like an hour beforehand. She could have been attacked just before. She could still have committed suicide. It could be she was attacked, she fought him off, and then she killed herself because she just had enough. We don't know, because don't forget, this is a really difficult moment for her. The Jimmy Orr, the guy that she loves, has gone away. She's really upset that he's not there anymore. Do you know, she's had him around with him for like 3 days, three years, every single day. So for her, this is kind of a big moment. And, you know, she's always looking for love, but the man that she thinks that she loves isn't there anymore. The missing £9. We still don't know. I mean, some people say £9, others say £6 that she had on her. We know that she did the day before, when she gave money to her brother, she went to the post office and she, as she always did, because the people at the post, unlike today where the post office closes at like ridiculous o'clock, back in the good old days, the post office stayed open all night, especially in the centre of London. It was always open, so you could go in there and post letters whenever you want to. And they knew her really well. She would turn up. And they said she'd always send off letters to Jimmy Orr, Mr. James Orr, as it was marked, but they'd often be to different addresses because he moved to different hotels. But and they remember her coming in. We've got receipts for when she posted a letter to Jimmy, so that's the day before she was murdered. So it's likely she sent him a big chunk of cash. She often did that. She often sent him as much as she could, but that letter was never received. So unfortunately, it's likely that he went to this detox place, a new place he'd never been to. She sent him a letter which had money in it. It probably got picked up by someone who was there. They opened it up, thought it, you know, shook it, went, oh, sounds like it's got money in it, had it for themselves. Who's going to prove otherwise? So, but we know that Jimmy wasn't involved in that because he was in detox. And we've got the dates and times when he was confirmed in, and he couldn't leave there. It's the middle of nowhere, and he didn't leave until much later. Let me just see. Got an interesting anonymous letter received on the 9th of November, 5 days after the murder, which says, "Sir, I have important information to give to you, but I cannot sign my name. French Fifi, who has been murdered, has a brother by the name of French Albert." I like the way they give everyone French this, French that. "They are of Russian parents born in Paris and her mother, where her mother still lives. Albert is a rascal who tries to make money quick." And then he goes on to explain about this club that Albert was working in. It looked like he was going to go to prison. Normally, Albert would turn around to his sister and say, "Can you pay off my fines and get me out?" And this time it was like 50 quid. I mean, she's already in debt to 100. Could be part of her debts. She couldn't raise the money to get him, so he ended up having to go to prison. Good, actually. He deserves to go to prison for just being a bit of a twat. Just poncing off his sister all day. And given the fact that she's making her money through the sex trade, so he's relying on her going out and getting shagged by drunken strangers so she can pay off his debts just because he's shit at his job. What a twat. Anyway, let's do some of the quiz questions. Quiz questions. Oh, let's see if my tea is that's not too bad. Question number one. What colour was Fifi's court shoe? It was blue. Question number two. What was the name of the man who sold condoms to sex workers? His name was Sidney Bloom, also known as Sidney Blumenthal. Question number three. On what street did Charles Branch, the taxi driver, claim he had picked up free Fifi and a tall man? It was Caledonian Road, which is just at the back of King's Cross Station. Question number four. How were Fifi's fingernails described? Oh dear. How was Fifi's fingernails described? Like animal claws. They were long, like talons. Oh, fishy burps. Fishy, cheesy burps. Question number five. What was the name of the PC first to attend the scene? He was PC Hill. Question number six. How much money was found in Fifi's handbag? It was 1p. Which does make you kind of wonder whether her handbag was robbed. It doesn't say in the report that the handbag wasn't open. Also, in the report, it says new handbag. So whether that was given to her as a gift or whether if it was a new handbag, whether she had another handbag and that handbag was missing. We don't know. There's a lot of bits in the report that kind of aren't there. It's like they forgot to add the detail about whether she was in bed or on bed. Like they entirely neglect that, and because of the way that her body is, we know that she was lying on the bed, but it's just one of those details that they just didn't bother to put in. And also because with a lot of her clients as well, she would never get into bed with them, because that was her bed, that was her private space. She would have sex with them on the bed, but never in the bed. So her maid said that she never had to make the bed. She never had to remake the bed. She just had to tidy it up afterwards. But if the gentleman paid enough money, she would get undressed in front of them, and she would get into bed with them. There you go. Details you didn't need to know. Question number 7. How much money was in the electricity meter? It was 1 shilling. Question number 8. Millie's friend, William Charles Hill, went by what alias? It was John Cow. What a lovely name. Question number 9. What colour was Fifi's jumper? It was a grey woolen jumper, although in a couple of reports they say it's green, which is really frustrating. And question number 10, I've gone with grey because more often than not they said grey, but it could have been green. Or it could have been grey-green, for all I know. And question number 10, why was it likely that she passed out early being strangled? Because she suffered from low blood pressure. Oh, Christ! Right, time to go to Starbucks and do some more work. Whoa, glad that was done. Good. Anyway, I hope you're enjoying the Soho Strangler. Next week, a new murder. That's the way it goes. It goes new murder of two parts, then new murder of two parts, then new murder of two parts, then new murder of two parts. And the new murder of two parts. Oh, Michael, you've just said 5 murders. I thought there were 4 murders. I give you a clue. There's actually 7. There's 7 murders in total. Fuck's sake. Right, that's me done. Have yourself a good week, folks. Stay safe and thank you for listening to the show. Have a good one. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.